Hi folks, it's Ray. The interview you're about to hear was recorded over the internet using Zoom, and unfortunately at times the connection wasn't fantastic. Bella and I have worked in the background to try and improve the audio quality as best we can, and we have agonized about whether we should release it or not. But it's such a thought-provoking, inspiring, and at times moving conversation that I think it would have just been wrong for us not to release it. And so we hope that you bear with us and that you enjoy it. I'm really proud of Gary for conducting the interview so well, and for the interviewee, Alex. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. And so I'm just going to hand over to Gary. Enjoy.
Welcome to Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast. Today we are joined by Alex Staniforth. Alex is a record-breaking adventurer, endurance athlete, author, mental health activist, and inspirational speaker. All this, and he's still only 24. Apologies in advance for the sound quality in places. This interview was recorded via the internet, and Alex was speaking from the foothills of the Lake District. Keep listening, because Alex is an incredible individual. Let's hear what he's got to say. It's just so incredible.
They didn't set limits. Are you a follower or a visionary? Can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Cause we're on a mission. Listen, it's beyond description. We don't want to fit in if we're living in a contradiction. We need a brand of passion that you can't imagine. Don't hesitate. Rub the lamp, lad.
You're listening to Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast. And with me today is Alex Staniforth, an inspirational speaker, adventurer, endurance athlete, author, and mental health advocate. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the Hub.
Hi. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here and sharing the story with you today.
And how are you doing?
Yes, very good. Getting prepped, ready for a busy month of speaking and trying to enjoy the hills and the lakes before it gets too cold and snowy, really. So I'm just trying to warm my hands up at the moment, actually.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, it's getting to that time of the year when it's need to fit a few more layers on when going out, and the weather can be a little bit less predictable.
Yeah, it's I guess it happens every year, but I think first one in the lakes, it's been a new change, and just trying to kind of get my health fixed as well as getting prepped for all these events coming up. And it's always a busy time on the speaking front as well, which is keeping me occupied. And obviously with the book again, although it does seem to get earlier and earlier every year, there's obviously that pushing in sales and trying to give the book a big push as well. So it's a productive time and exciting things happening, really.
Yeah, that's all great. And you are based in the Lake District now.
Yeah, so I moved to Kendal in March, which has been a big change in a variety of ways, change being a good thing, but obviously challenging as well. While I've been here, it's just been a case of trying to, get settled, and also trying to combine not only work commitments, but the temptation to get out in the hills as much as I want to as well. So it's been trying to strike the balance too.
Yes, and a beautiful area to live and work.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's been a big part of my personal journey. It was in the lakes where I originally kind of found the inspiration for some of the some of the challenges that we're talking about today. And with my work, I'm really fortunate that, I can kind of work anywhere, really, because I speak all over, all over the UK. And so Kendal's fairly accessible to all those areas, on the train or on the motorway, which is quite handy. And when I'm not speaking, it's an inspiring place to be for writing and working on projects and getting that outdoor inspiration, really.
Yes, definitely. I'm definitely a fan of the lakes. And there's so much we could talk about, because you have packed in so much. So is it right, you're 23?
24 now, yes.
24 now. Oh, getting old now.
Getting old already, yeah. I think actually I need to update my Twitter profile. It still says I'm 23, so I'll go with that one for now. It's a smaller number.
Yeah, keep it 23, I would. As I said, so there's you've packed so much into your young life already, but you did mention the book, and so let's start with that. And this is your second book, and it's called Another Peak. Yeah. And this is largely, but not exclusively, about your probably most recent challenge. I think it's 2017, and climb the UK.
Yes.
And
yes.
So this was an attempt to reach the highest point of every county in the UK. So that's 100 county tops. And the attempt was to do that in just 72 days.
That was back in summer of 2017. So climbing the UK was all human powered, walking, running, cycling, and even kayaking a little bit. Biggest challenge I've done in many ways. It was my new Everest, and was all fundraising and raising awareness for mental health, specifically in young people, where I feel there's a real lack of support available. And really took me to quite literally, you know, the highs and the lows of the UK, to every corner, and getting to really explore and appreciate just the diversity and the beauty that we have on our own doorstep. And the book, Another Peak, goes through that whole journey. You know, it shares the stories, it shares the places and the people, but also covers some of my own personal story prior to and after that as well. So it's a real roller coaster of a book. It's probably very different to my first book in the sense that it's it goes very deep into my, you know, mental health experiences and the kind of, you know, the kind of sense of vulnerability from that, and putting more out there than ever before, really, in the hope that it can help other people to understand it better and to relate to it, and to help the people that might be in a similar place, and also exploring the connection between the outdoors and adventure and mental health, as we've heard so much about that nowadays, and just the power of that. So it felt like a good place to explore that as well.
And what made you decide to do the County Tops as a challenge?
Good question. And it's always that why, you know, and I think when you're looking for a challenge, it almost feels like a bit of an entrepreneurial type inventor stage, because, you know, when you've done challenges before, or I guess, you know, as an adventurer, if that's kind of a correct title, you essentially have that need to keep on doing challenges. And for me, the outdoor challenges have always been my way of dealing with the personal challenges. And you get to that point where you're kind of ready for another challenge, and you spend some time trying to kind of work out what that's going to be. And it can be quite a slow process. You know, you're essentially, you know, working on different ideas and possibilities and what's feasible, what, you know, something that really excites you. And it can be very easy. I mean, with Everest, which, you know, I guess I'll talk about shortly, that was very much a very quick and instant decision. But after then, I've had to think a bit more kind of carefully and creatively to come up with challenge ideas that serve a purpose and excite me. So with climbing the UK, I think I was looking close to home. After my expeditions in the Himalayas and not having the success I envisaged due to a few disasters and things, I started to kind of question the whole purpose of high altitude and climbing Everest and climbing these big mountains, and whether I was really going to find peace with myself or find a sense of achievement, and could I make a bigger difference close to home, you know, doing a UK challenge and appreciating what's on our own doorstep. I'd been inspired by a British girl called Elise Downing, who actually, fortunately, she wrote the foreword for my book, which I was really pleased about. And she ran around the coast of the UK over 9 months the year before. And I guess I saw how she was getting people involved and inspired and engaged along the way, and made me wonder if I could create something similar. And I guess I've always wanted to go off the beaten path. I've never wanted to kind of follow the trend. And so I was looking for something a bit different. And the countertop idea came about just from researching, or perhaps just from reading something online. And essentially, you produce a criteria for the challenge, and then it's just about finding something that just grabs me. And then I need to have a vision. You know, we all need to have that vision of the finish line, or, you know, whatever success is going to be for that particular goal.
Yes.
And then after a few months of playing with the idea, it all fell into place. I had that vision of what success would be. And once I got that, I've got everything I need, really. And so it just took about 3 months to get there. And then in January 2017, I committed, that commitment being the most important thing. And then in May 2017, I was on the start line.
Yes, and you record and chart that journey in the book, Another Peak. And I've read the book, and it's a fascinating read. It's a very open book, and we'll come on to the health side in a moment. But just reading the sort of the places that you went to and the itinerary that you gave yourself, so just 72 days to fit all 100 tops in, and this was largely under your own steam, so either cycling, walking, there was a bit of kayaking, and the occasional lift, but by and by it was under your own steam. And you could see in the book the number of times where you're just thinking, you know, this guy is just seems to be himself so hard, and why is he doing that?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I guess it was one of those things, it seems very natural to me, but to somebody reading it, it is hard to explain. Ultimately, I think it's having that vision in mind, having that vision of success, and that becomes more important than failure. And ultimately, I think not having any choice, you know, either because you've got a schedule to keep to, or you've got to reach, you know, from A to B. But equally, I think that threshold, that ability to push on like that, it's going to be different to everybody. And so, again, what obviously may have surprised somebody else, you know, might seem very normal to me or somebody else because of that past experience. And I think you build that level of resilience, that ability to kind of endure and carry on. And perhaps that's why we keep need to set these goals, because we keep pushing that bar and we're able to tolerate a lot more every time. And as you would have read in the book, there were times when I met that threshold and I broke down. You know, I'm sat there sobbing my heart out on a mountain. But ultimately, every time that happens, I think you push that threshold that little bit higher.
But it's interesting because you said there was no choice. And for many people, they would be saying, but Alex, you did have a choice. You could have said, enough's enough. I've had a really good go at this. But really, because it was not just the, you know, the distances you were doing, it was the time pressure, constantly fighting that schedule. And you also were, I think for much of it, carrying, an injury. So you're having to push through a pain barrier, and that must also add to the mental pressure of the challenge. So I think for many people, they would have said, look, I've really given it a go, but it's been really brutal, more brutal than I thought. And yeah, I can give this another go another time. But you chose to carry on.
Yeah, I mean, there is a choice. But ultimately, you get to that point of burning desire where the other choice doesn't feel like an option, and it's that internal conflict between, you know, having a real excuse and feeling like you're, you know, giving up too soon. I mean, with the injury, I mean, yeah, that was a small tear in my quad, and then I had a chest infection, which was just pretty uncomfortable. But there weren't any real barrier as to stop. I mean, the importance of achieving the goal was much more important to me than stopping. And I think ultimately the thought of giving up earlier, it just scared me, you know, it terrified me. After Everest and after everything else, I mean, where I've been stopped by things that were outside of my control, the attraction to climb the UK was that everything really within reason was in my control. And ultimately it's learning to tell the difference between the kind of that inner voice, you know, that kind of like inner chimp, as I call it, which is between, have I really got a good reason to stop, or is it just an excuse? And there's that kind of gut feeling that I think is, I mean, I guess trying to phrase this in the most, you know, the best way possible, but I think it's probably the reason why people say I've done a lot is because I've kept going when most people would have quit. But you back that up with experience. And the thing is, I guess the kind of irony is that the more of these things we do, the more evidence we have in our own minds to draw on of those times when we very, very nearly quit but didn't. They kind of work against you after a while because you think of those times when you thought you were going to quit and you carried on and then you met success and you enjoyed the rewards of success. And so many people were supporting me, believing in me, that I didn't feel like I really had a choice to quit. Times on the Everest journey when I did, and I think it just, it, you know, I think I can accept failure when it's out of my hands.
Yes.
So it wasn't so much a fear of failure, it was a fear of making the wrong choice.
And so this is a really around mindset.
Yeah. I mean, mindset and psychology really, really interest me. And it's what I talk a lot about in business is trying to translate those experiences from the outdoors into how we can manage challenges at work. There's a lot of it applies, you know. I'm not saying the company should be taking their staff out on a Scottish mountain in a hoolie, but I try and share some tips so they don't have to.
Yes. Well, I think they should anyway, just to experience it.
It's character building, sure. But I think ultimately it's having that burning desire. You know, it's where the fear of failure becomes bigger than the fear of discomfort or dealing with that difficult situation at the time.
And so does that drive you more than wanting to succeed?
I think that I would probably say they're equal. You know, the desire to succeed ultimately becomes bigger than the fear of failure. It has to. Otherwise, you will find an excuse. And then I think I just hear it quite a lot when people say, oh, you know, I'd love to do that and I'd love to do this and I wish I'd done that. And I just never wanted to be in that position. It means life can be quite an emotional roller coaster, you know, peaks and troughs. But
yes,
I'd much rather favour that way than kind of staying in my comfort zone too much.
Yes, and of course, life can be like that with ups and downs, even if you're not taking on huge challenges.
I think the higher you go, though, the bigger goals you set, the further you fall. And I just learned to accept that, really.
Yes. And one of the things I noticed in the book is because there were moments when it was tough and you're questioning yourself and you're wondering, what am I doing? But you are very thankful for the support you've got from mentors. So people who've done their own big challenges, but also people just kind of ordinary folk who just heard about the challenge and wanted to just either walk with you or do one of the tops. And I think there was a young lady who was sending flapjacks by post around the country.
Yes.
So what was that like, having that kind of support?
Oh, that was fantastic. And that was really what the highlight of it for me. And ultimately, I think it just really, really surprised me. But in a positive way, it's just how much support there was from strangers who became friends. And I think ultimately the mental health message that I was putting out there, sharing my own challenges, is sort of something that a lot of people related to and connected with, and therefore people put their hands up too and they want to come and join you. And that for me, just in those difficult times, is absolutely what kept me going, without a doubt. You know, and again, it feeds into the talks I do in businesses, just about having that sense of openness at work. And actually, being resilient isn't about being mentally tough for yourself. It's about having that support network around you as well.
So the strength is not in being stoic and a bit of a martyr about it and kind of just keeping it all in, but it's actually having the strength to say, I feel as if I could do with some help, or just to talk things through.
Resilience and you know, resilience is also a lot about resources around us and being willing to be vulnerable. You know, I think all of, what what I took most away from the challenge was that if one person puts their hand up first is what allows other people to be open, and then that builds trust, and that can only be a positive thing.
Yes. And in the book, as well as it being a record of your the physical journey and so on, you're very open about the eating disorder and bulimia and how that was affecting you through that challenge and how you were reflecting on that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been more open about that than ever before. I mean, my first book, I was still in the stage where it was quite a private thing. And it was a big step for me. But prior to the challenge, I'd kind of done a blog openly about that struggle, and I was in a much later stage of it. And so I was able to speak more openly about it because it was other people being open about their struggles that first really allowed me to be open in mind and take that first sort of step towards accepting it myself and also helping other people and giving that sense of, you know, of being able to do something positive about it. So it was very open about it in a variety of ways because I think, as I said, it just helps other people too. And as terrifying as it was, I reflect now on something that previously I'd been kind of in tears about in front of my GP, you know, who's now out there in a book for the world to see, which is something I'm proud of. And I think I do it because I hope all other young men are able to do the same. And if they do, that makes it worthwhile, really. It's not about sympathy. It's not about, trying to get praise. It's just about not being afraid to be open about these things. And I think ultimately, if we're going to break down the stigma around them, it's going to take more of that.
Yes. And that's really the bit beyond the actual challenge, which is really important to you. I mean, I'm just going to repeat some of the stats from your Climb the UK challenge. I've taken these from your website, so I hope they're accurate. So we've got 4,782 miles on the bike, cycling. You've got 484 miles on foot, 8 kilometers by kayak. And if you add up all the different bits of ascent that you did with all the tops, we've got 383,871 feet, which is, I'm told, 13 times the height of Everest.
Yeah, quite a long way. but really, people hear all the stats and I guess they see the sense of challenge. And I think that was the message, is that, you know, having a mental illness, having a mental health condition is no barrier to achievement, you know, physically or mentally. And I guess that was what I wanted to share, really.
It's a great message. And there is one more stat I'm going to share, which might even be a more important one for you, Alex. And that is that the challenge itself was also a fundraising challenge. And your challenge raised £25,271 for the mental health charity Young Minds UK. You must have been thrilled with that sum.
Absolutely. The support I had, the generosity, and again, I think just because it was something that people related to, it was staggering. And halfway through the challenge, I hit the target. So in the moment of spontaneity, I just doubled it. And then I thought, oh bugger, what have I done? But then it kept coming and going. And then I had a lot of support then. And then when I got towards the final peak, Morvamai in North Wales, my sponsors, which was the Westgrove Group in Warrington, who've supported me for over 5 years now, they presented me with the check that pushed me over that final amount, that pushed it to £20,000. So that obviously was the best any I could ask for. From then on, more sponsorship kept coming in, and then it was getting closer to 25,000. So I was then fortunate to be shortlisted for the Pride of Britain Fundraiser of the Year.
Yes.
Northwest. And that inspired me that I needed to do more. You know, I had to keep on going. So before I lost my kind of endurance, I decided to fit in one last challenge of the year, which was trying to cycle to Edinburgh in 24 hours, which is about 310 miles. That alone got some more sponsorship. And again, it's hard to get an exact figure, but it was about £25,000 in the end.
Yeah, fantastic. Fantastic. And just to conclude this bit about another peak and the Climb the UK Challenge, where was the finish point?
The final peak of the whole Climb the UK Challenge was Morvai, which is the highest point of Flintshire in North Wales. I wanted something that was close to home, in Chester, something where a lot of people could be there and could come and walk it and you know, and celebrate the final top. And it was, that was part of the vision I had from the start, you know, was having that kind of crowd on the final peak. And it was exactly everything I dreamed it would be. I can feel the goosebumps now, actually. It's not just because I'm cold. it was a magical moment, and it was like the Everest that I never had. You know, it was just as good, and it made me realize I didn't really need Everest anymore. You know, there were bigger challenges that had the same effect, and that it's about the journey. It's about the difference we make along the way and how we pick ourselves back up. So having got to that moment, you know, I rode the wave for a while and then got work on the book, which came out in July this year. So obviously a long, long time period, really, because it kept going and going.
Yes, yes. But what a beautiful place to finish. I've walked up Morvai many, many times because, as you know, I used to live in Chester myself. So great finish. And, of course, you had the big picture and you had the wide shot, so which people can obviously see. I think
it had everything
and so on. Yeah, yeah, really.
Yeah, it had the sunshine, the Union Jack above my head, the crowd, the warmth. Yeah, that kind of money shot. You know, Jonathan, who got the photo, it was amazing. It was everything I dreamed it would be.
Yeah, a great finale to an incredible challenge. And that brings me on to really, you know, how did someone like yourself get into being so passionate about the outdoors and adventure? Because I'm just going to run through some of the experiences you had through childhood. So I think you had some mild epilepsy, panic attacks, OCD, anxiety, low self-esteem, bullying through your school years, a lifelong stammer. This doesn't sound like, you know, the obvious candidate for somebody who's going to get into the outdoors and adventure and motivational speaking. So how did you find this and discover this interest in the outdoors?
Yeah, it doesn't sound like the ideal candidate, does it? Well, I mean, you know, without a shameless plug, I'd say to get the full story, the book will do a better job. But I guess to cut the story short, I mean, ultimately, I found the outdoors by chance when I was about, probably about 13, actually, because I had a very normal start. You know, my parents gave everything I needed. I was very fortunate. They were never really outdoorsy themselves, so it kind of didn't come from them. And when I got to high school, things got a whole lot more challenging and everybody's sort of in this scrum trying to find themselves and fit in. And I never really wanted to fit in and I never really felt like I was, you know, I was good enough. I never wanted to be part of that beaten path. And I think the key turning point was when I was 13, I went on holiday in Turkey with my mum and decided to try something called paragliding. Ah. It's quite an extreme sport. I'd never done anything like that before. But before that, I'd just done a bit of running, a bit of cycling. Never have really had the confidence to do much else. But
and just to explain to the listeners, for those who don't know what paragliding is.
Sure. So basically, it's not as extreme as skydiving. Paragliding is basically when you jump off a hill or a mountain with an open parachute and you glide down. Similar to hang gliding, but it's all kind of hill-based. You launch off hills anywhere around the world. Yes. But in Turkey, it's very, very popular. I'd always been interested in flying and planes. So I saw this advertised and I just said to mum one day, you know, I've got to try this. And she was really shocked. you know, where's this come from? But my parents have always sort of supported me to do what I want. And I guess I started to question the limits I put on myself. and decided, you know, it didn't have to be this way anymore. You know, nothing had to hold me back. And really, it only takes one experience outside of our comfort zones to change our perspective, as it did. And I think I started to kind of realize that we don't always get to choose our challenges, but we can choose how we respond to them. So that changed my whole life, really, because I found this passion, this confidence I never had before. I kept challenging myself, kept trying more outdoor sports, and wasn't afraid to be different anymore, really. And I guess as the confidence grew and grew, I kept on doing more and more things, and was then invited hill walking in the Lake District with a friend when I was about 14, something I would never have really wanted to do before. With anxiety at a time, it was very, very difficult. But again, it was life-changing, because it was that first walk in the fells when I had the kind of question of, where is Mount Everest? Uh-huh. And that question set me off on this world of fascination with the world's highest peak, and deciding that was going to be the ultimate thing to overcome, you know, after the epilepsy, the stammer, everything else, and just decided at 14 that one day I was going to do it. Never could have imagined that I'd be there at base camp 4 years later, really.
Yes, because you say you'd thrown yourself into a number of different activities, like I think scuba diving, rock climbing, mountain biking, running, which I know you still love doing, and you took on the Three Peaks Challenge, Mont Blanc you've done. So that's not a stroll in the park, is it?
It was a big step. You know, I mean, nowadays, you know, it's compared to the rest, it's, you know, it was just a stepping stone, but it's about constantly challenging ourselves and taking practical steps towards, you know, achieving a goal. And obviously Everest requires a lot of prior experience at altitude, and on hindsight, did I have enough? I'm not sure. But I think, it was all about chasing that passion, really, and keeping on disproving these limitations. And I guess the outdoors became my way of dealing with the personal challenges, really, and finally feeling good about myself for the first time.
Yes, and we're going to come to the Himalayas experiences very, very shortly. But I just want to touch on, because I think Mont Blanc, was that 2012?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so
about,
that was...
Yeah, it was about, well... About two years later, really. It was quite soon after.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, so that was the same year as you were also a London 2012 Olympic torchbearer.
So, yes, 2012, I was very, very lucky to be selected as one of the 8,000 torchbearers. Carried the torch from my hometown of Chester. Experience I'll never, ever forget. And that was in recognition for the fundraising for charity that I'd done through the Three Peaks Challenge and through Mont Blanc. That experience itself was a really big driver, inspiration to keep doing more and keep on trying to challenge myself and make a difference, really.
Great, fantastic. And how does that come about? Does somebody nominate you, or do people just find you and say, oh, this guy should hold the torch?
So the torch relay was mostly done by public nominations, which is good because people had the chance to obviously, you know, have an input and put names forward. So my friend's mum nominated me, and obviously for that I'm very, very grateful.
Yes, a fantastic experience, and in a great year for athletics as well. And the following year, I think, is when you had your first experience of the Himalayas and Barunsi.
Yeah, so after Mont Blanc, I then got injured from running, and so I hit my first real low point with anxiety and depression, and then the eating disorder kicked in because I couldn't run, picked up bad habits. And I guess in that time, I'd been sort of proactively taking steps towards Everest, which was going to be a future goal, but it didn't have a deadline at that point.
Yeah.
And whilst depressed and feeling pretty hopeless, I realized that had I attempted Everest in 2014, that would make me the second youngest Brit, which was going to be a really good hook for the sponsorship. But more than anything, it just gave me that sense of purpose, that sense of, you know, that reason to get out of bed and fight back at the time. So I committed to focus on what I could control and started, you know, my proper fundraising campaign for Everest in 2014, which helped me through that time. And I also then had to fundraise to go and attempt, you know, a prior peak. That was going to be absolutely crucial, was getting experience on a 7,000 meter peak beforehand,
yes.
Which is a peak called Burunsi. And that, again, involved a lot of fundraising just to get there. So straight away, I mean, I was having to, you know, commit 100% and take these risks and start getting the funds together through corporate sponsorship. So it was essentially a full-time job for a year and a half and a gap year that kind of didn't really end or go as planned.
Yes, and we should stress that these vast, huge mountain peaks, that kind of level, it doesn't matter how experienced you are or how many times you may have summited. You know, there's so many different factors in actually getting to the top, and you know, many of those factors are outside of your control. In fact, that's really what we'll be coming on to next. So you know, just not getting to the top, you know, that actually happens a lot more than people might think, because they just see the stories about the people who've made it to the top. So I think we should stress that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we all focus on the success and the reaching the top, but we all know that actually that's just a very small part of the parcel of mountaineering. And perhaps that's what makes it rewarding, but there is a lot of failure involved. And it teaches us a lot, yeah.
Yeah. So 2014 then, so it's Everest, it's your dream. Tell me about that year.
Well, the first attempt on Everest was led by a British mountain guide called Tim Mosdell, who I'd done my first rock climb with in the lakes many years ago. And I'd always decided I liked his ethos. I wanted to be under his leadership. So basically, it was the end of March. We flew out to Lukla. This was, you know, having sort of spent a year trying to raise the money through corporate sponsorship, which I got together about 4 weeks before the trip was due to start. And we were on this, you know, this 2 month expedition. It takes 3 weeks alone just to get to base camp. And a day before we got there, there was sadly a major avalanche, which tragically killed 16 climbing Sherpas.
Hmm.
So the situation got very quickly out of hand, and we basically had no choice but to pack up and go home. Without stepping a single foot on Everest. So obviously that was a real kick in the teeth. I mean, obviously we had no right to complain when we're going home safe. But it's like, what do I do now? You know, how do you bounce back from this? But then you kind of lose your fear of failure because you realize that sometimes it's inevitable. You know, it's just an opportunity to learn from it, to come back stronger, to train more that mindset, you know, on the psychology side. So that's basically, you know, what I did. Started fundraising for Nepal second time round, having really fallen in love with the country and the people. And yeah, in some ways, it apart from, of course, you know, the scale of the events and tragedy, it turned out to be a positive in some ways, because on that second trip in 2015, I was much better prepared. But as I found out, you know, that doesn't always mean success either. We got to base camp, same team, same format, you know, everything was going really well.
Yes.
I was 19 second time round, so obviously the youngest on the team by a long way. But we were going through the Khumbu Icefall, which is the most dangerous part of the climb, to camp one. You know, we were starting to actually get going on the mountain when the Nepal earthquake hit. And well, it's a long story, but basically we were hit by a powder, you know, a powder avalanche. And for the first time in my life at 19, I was thinking, you know, this is it, game over. Luckily, we all escaped pretty much unharmed, but we were trapped at camp one for 2 nights.
Yes.
The route to base camp had gone. We're told we'd be there for a week, you know, and we had no idea that actually base camp down below had been pretty much wiped out, you know, been hit by a much bigger avalanche triggered by the earthquake. And yeah, our home on the mountain had gone, and sadly, three of our team had gone with it. And yeah, breakfast that morning was the last time we'd see them.
Yes, that's right. And this, this journey and all of the tragedy of it, this is covered in your first book, Icefall, which is a fantastic read. I mean, it's a terrible read as well because of what happened, but it really does show the challenge and the risk of it and the uncertainty of everything and how it doesn't matter how much you've prepared, how good the team is. If nature isn't playing ball, there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. And I think I'm right saying that earthquake was the worst in Nepal for about 80 years. It was really powerful. And people may have seen on the news that footage of the avalanche kind of coming through part of the base camp, absolutely terrifying images.
And obviously it was a life-changing effect, well, event for anybody, but I think to have that so young really gave me an appreciation for how fragile life is and what really matters. And it sort of changed my whole purpose in life. I mean, at the time, it took me a while to pick myself back up again. You know, I hit a major low point with, with mental health. I hit this major low point in mental health again, trying to find sense and purpose from all this. And obviously a very difficult time. I mean, obviously I was very lucky to be back home safe with my family. But I guess I found a new purpose in giving back and trying to make a difference. And it sent me on a different path, because even without reaching the top, even without success, I mean, that didn't really matter. It's always been about how you pick yourself back up again. And I started doing more challenges to fundraise for Everest, to fundraise for the earthquake victims in Nepal. One of them was cycling the equivalent height of Everest in 24 hours, called Everesting. And then started working on my book Icefall, which ended up telling a very different story to what we planned, but in some ways was a very unique story. And I started doing a lot more speaking and writing and fundraising, and in some ways it took me on a very different path, and I'm quite glad it did, actually. I think it taught me a lot more and brought much better opportunities.
Yes, I mean, just to recap for the listeners, so 2014, you were 18 and, you know, the attempt was not possible because of the avalanche. And in 2015, you're 19 and your second attempt, again, Mother Nature not playing ball. So you were, I think, pretty close to 6,000 meters up, and, you know, you, as you describe in the book, were just, as with others in the team, lucky that you actually sort of were able to, survive that, and sadly, obviously, there were others at base camp that didn't. But for someone so young, you know, still a teenager, and to have gone through that, I think for anybody, that's quite something to experience and go through. I mean, how did you deal with that?
Good point. I mean, I think, because of the earlier challenges, I guess I was already naturally quite good at dealing with adversity and bouncing back, but obviously I'd never experienced anything like this before. I guess the only people that really could understand it were friends who'd been in the army. You know, my friend Richard at the time was a real godsend, because he'd seen much worse at a similar age, and that sense of, you know, you've just got to grow from it. You've just got to grow from these things, otherwise they'll grow on you, and it's how you pick yourself back up again. And I guess what helped me through it was throwing myself into something positive, you know, to fundraising for charity, to writing about it. And that sense of, you know, accepting that, you know, I was saved, they weren't. So I don't know why, I'll never know why, but I've just got to make it count. Mm. And that's what I've been doing ever since, really.
Yes. And I remember from the book Icefall, there's a picture, a photo of, I think, when you arrived back in the UK at the airport and you're hugging your mum. And yeah. I think the caption said something.
He's not the Messiah, he's a very naughty boy. Sorry, I beat you to it there.
Yes, yeah, that's it. You remembered it. So I was just going to say that, you know, what was it like for, you know, your mum and family? Because they must be thinking, you know, what must they be thinking? Their teenage son.
Yeah.
going out again, and then surely there must have been somewhere where it's like, right, that's it, you're not doing anything anymore like this.
Wouldn't want to stop me, you know, doing what I'm passionate about, what was important to me. But if you know, the child, I guess it's very, very difficult, more than I can ever understand. And so that's why I'm very grateful for that. I mean, I think they were glad to see the back of, you know, the back of Everest for a while. And that sense of kind of, I was out there, you know, not being able to kind of do anything to help. On the phone to me when I was stuck at Camp One. I mean, we were at, what, 6,100 metres nearly for 2 days. I can't imagine, but I've been very, very fortunate that I've always had that support network of mentors and also my friends and family who have believed in me, but I've wanted to, you know, I've had every reason to give up on myself. And everybody needs that. Everybody needs that support. And, you know, I'm very grateful that mine's always been there, but I think they're very proud of what I've done, but they don't realise that without their support, it wouldn't be possible, you know. And life gives us enough excuses and reasons not to follow our dreams. So, yeah.
Yeah, that support network is really important, isn't it? And a lot of what you're doing around these challenges, I mean, whether it's, you know, the high-level altitude or lower down, there's always risk involved. So how do you choose what to take on? And when you're doing them, again, going back to the book, Another Peak, you know, how do you decide, you know, when to push on and when to just say, okay, I'll stop here and I'll reset tomorrow and work out a way to make it still happen? How do you make those decisions?
You've always got to adapt and overcome. I mean, with Everest, the risk's always going to be there. And our leader, Tim, always spoke about, you know, raising the safety net as high as you can. There's always going to be that objective risk that we can't really stop. But if you, you know, if you're on Everest, you accept that risk, you're there to achieve something massive, and therefore it's worth it. The biggest risk can be taking no risk. I mean, as we found on Everest, I mean, had we stayed at base camp in our safe place, probably, you know, where there's less risk, well, that morning it would have killed us. Or obviously most likely would have done. So I think ultimately it's accepting what you can control and what you can't. And on climbing the UK was different because obviously there's a lot less objective risk. There's things like traffic and illness and hypothermia and the conditions and things like that. Again, you can minimize that to a certain level. There's always going to be that unpredictability. So I guess you focus on what you can control. And when things go wrong, you know, as my friend Richard, he said to me, you know, well, whatever goes wrong, there is always a solution, you know. And the three words he said were relentless forward motion. Just keep on moving.
Yes.
But ultimately, when I got ill, you know, it was having somebody who's not emotionally connected, who's got a clearer perspective, who was able to say, look, mate, you know, it's much better now to stop and lose a day than to, you know, have to stop the challenge altogether because you deteriorate or something worse happens. Ultimately, though, you've got to make the decision and you're limited by gut feel. So I think having a second opinion that you can trust, somebody that's going to give you the right advice, tell you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear, I think is key. And again, it's choosing that support network and having that trust, but ultimately following your own gut feel is key, really.
Yeah. And would you say that's similar advice you would give to businesses and leaders and managers in organizations?
Absolutely. I think having a team, having second opinions, but you've got to make sure that the people that you're listening to have got the same vision in mind as you. You know, if I wanted somebody to tell me not to do something that I didn't want to do, I'd know exactly who to go and ask. But ultimately, I think we all need to have mentors, we need to have coaches and people that aren't connected to something, because we can often get in our own way. So, yeah, absolutely. I'd say you know, ask a second opinion, but make sure it's from people that have your vision in mind and your best interest at heart. People that can see the bigger picture when you're kind of, you've got, you know, you, as the saying goes, you can't see the wood for the trees. And I think we can get stuck in that mindset where we think we can't help ourselves. And I can force myself to go and sit down with, you know, a mentor, and by the end of it, I just have this clarity, you know, this weight lifts. And just that reassurance, you know, it might not be what you want to hear, but it's what you need to hear.
Yes, yes, definitely. I think there's so much. And again, that sense of challenge, and you said yourself, you know, you need a vision. So again, for an organization, being able to perhaps really set the sights a little bit higher than they might otherwise think, or just even see the possibility of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, if I was having a really tough day, like I was many times, I wouldn't necessarily talk to tell mum, because she'd be kind of swaying more towards the option of taking it easier when I had no real reason to, but to carry on. She doesn't want to hear her son knackered, exhausted, scared, wet, scared, you know, alone. But equally, it's uncomfortable, but there's no realistic reason why I couldn't carry on. Whereas I've got other people I spoke to, like Steve, or, you know, Steve or Chris, who would sort of say to me, you know, you've always been known for the way you kind of, you know, get back on your bike and carry on pushing. And they kind of know what to say, which will kind of reignite the spark, really, because they understand how I work. But also sometimes reassuring me in that I've made the right decision. And I think ultimately it's imagining both outcomes and just seeing which one feels best.
Yeah. And the Climb the UK challenge again, so this was, the theme really was that Everest, the mountain, is not the only summit. We can all have our own Everest, and yeah, that could be both a challenge we face or want to do, or it could also be a dream or an aspiration, a goal to achieve and so on. And certainly after your Everest experiences, you, as you say, you went on to do fundraising for Nepal. So the walk for Nepal, I think that raised about, what, £35,000 for?
The walk for Nepal events, I think I've raised nearly £40,000 actually now over 4 years. I mean, obviously that's not me, that's just all the fundraisers and the walkers that took part. But certainly made a big difference for FaZe, who supports people in the most isolated parts of Nepal to, you know, empower themselves, really.
Yes. And could you just say a little bit about FaZe Worldwide? Because yeah, it's a charity and maybe not everyone's heard of them, and what your involvement with them is?
Yeah, I mean, FaZe are a small charity. They're registered in the UK, but they work mostly in, you know, the remote parts of Nepal. You know, working with the people really off the beaten track in education and healthcare, mostly. And FaZe stands for Practical Help Achieving Self-Empowerment. So basically helping people help themselves, which I think is really key. You know, you're not just giving them a handout. And after the earthquake, I wanted to do like a anniversary walk, a walk for Nepal. My friend Jeff inspired the idea. Jeff Smith from Big Moose, which is another amazing charity project. I wanted to do something, you know, nationwide. I wanted a UK charity that was going to support the event, you know, because doing these fundraising things really depends on having a good backing from the charity. Yes. Now, FaZe had a small team, but we're very committed, really, you know, bought into the idea. And basically that following spring, we did Snowdon. We had 120 people raising over £20,000. Massive success, really pleased. I was then asked to be an ambassador for FaZe, so just to sort of support their work. They've also got Brian Blessed and Rosie Swale Pope as their patrons.
Yes.
So obviously in good company. And yeah, I like that they're a small charity that I can work with on a personal basis. And they've done 4 Walk for the Pauls now. You know, Ben Nevis, Scarfell Pike and Snowdon. As you know, from Scarfell Pike, we had a very, very hot day.
Yes, I remember joining you on that one with the other people. Yeah, very warm.
Yeah, but that's been my involvement with them. I think more recently, my charity work has been focused on mental health.
Yes, and you really become, you know, one of the people that's going around and sharing, you know, your experiences and your stories. And you've been doing work in schools, colleges, I think universities, and you talk to businesses and senior managers, and you talk at conferences and events. So it's you know, great to see you, you know, getting out there and sharing that, and you know, then supporting this topic, which really does seem to be coming to the fore now. It's something that wasn't talked about much years ago, but it seems to be something now that people are ready to talk about more openly.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a big topic. It has been for a while, and I think it's still very much an open topic. I think it will be for some time to come. Almost, you know, we're hearing about it every day now, which is great. I think it's important we don't lose the meaning behind it, we don't lose the focus on what we're trying to change. Ultimately, yeah, it's something that people are now addressing, and especially in the workplace, I think businesses are realizing the need to provide real interventions, you know, not just ticking boxes, but actually accepting the pressures and the stresses and how that's leading to mental ill health. And I have a lot of demand for speaking about it in businesses. I've got a conference later this month I'm doing about, you know, mental health and resilience. I've just done a series of conferences on behalf of a trainer, a 359 consultancy, doing some events then for a corporate conference. I think I've certainly had a lot of demand from businesses and schools and education to talk about it. Having that combination of not only the adventure side, but personal experience of mental ill health and the practical things that we can all do. And I think addressing and relating to the challenges that young people are facing as well.
Yes. And for businesses and organisations, I mean, is there sort of like two or three key points that you could share around, you know, what they could be doing or doing more around mental health and employees?
Yeah, I mean, I think generally, I guess this is my fear, is that it's that there's a risk of it becoming a bit of a kind of trying to tick boxes rather than actual real interventions. And I think businesses are being very proactive and realizing the need to invest in mental health first aiders and, you know, better support, and, you know, realizing that these are, you know, in uncertain times and are trying to, you know, browse and cope with all the stresses and pressures and not switching off from technology, and maintaining well-being and that sense of openness that it's okay to talk about these things. So I think it's I think discrimination is obviously a major problem. I think I was speaking about recently that 94% of business leaders admitted discriminating against somebody with mental ill health. And obviously you can see that's a problem, because employees are going to be less likely to talk about it, and therefore they'll leave it unsolved, and therefore it's going to become a full-blown condition, which there could have been an opportunity to intervene beforehand.
Yes.
So I think ultimately it's creating an open culture. And I think that starts from everybody in the business putting their hand up and having the opportunity to speak openly. I think investing in support, such as mental health first aiders, having wellbeing programs in place is obviously vital. And I think ultimately it's, you know, it's just having a sense of openness where everybody feels able to share their challenges. And I mean, I've not worked in that environment, so it's difficult for me to you know, give examples of that. But I think ultimately it's the small things can make a biggest difference. And having people aware of what to do and how to help, because people think there's often a need to fix, when sometimes we just need to be heard. You know, we need a chance just to speak. And if people can't understand it, you know, just to listen and offer a cup of tea can make a massive difference, you know. And I think it's just not underestimating the small steps that businesses, that everybody in the business can take. And whether it's doing events or providing opportunities to share stories across management and, you know, every level of the business, I think is really important. And One intervention I would like to talk about is a project I've recently started called Mind Over Mountains, which is a social enterprise.
Yes.
We're improving mental health basically through outdoor experiences, but combining guided hill walking, NLP coaching, mindfulness, inspirational speakers, and just a chance to really switch off and disconnect from, you know, social media and all these self-comparison. And we're looking to work with, you know, business teams as well as the general public. And so we're going to hopefully, you know, be able to work with businesses as a way to support staff who might need those self-help skills. Because ultimately, if we can focus on resilience, I think we can intervene with a lot of these things in the first place.
Yes, and it's a really interesting you used the word resilience there, because in our previous podcasts, Ray and myself were talking about resilience being one of the strengths of leaders and also managers. So that's really interesting that you used that particular word. I do think that's a quality that's really important. And the Mind Over Mountains, I think that's a fantastic idea and such a natural idea in many senses, all senses, just being out in the open and walking and the fresh air. Even if you can do that, just in a park or by the sea, fantastic. But there really is something about walking in the hills and mountains that's a little bit special.
Yeah, and it makes sense. I mean, I think we're always skipping the basics, looking for that quick fix in our modern world, when ultimately, if people are in an office all day and, you know, they're not having that culture where they can switch off, take breaks, go out for a walk, then it's only inevitable we're going to run into trouble.
Yes. And of course, in your book, Another Peak, there were many examples, I think, where obviously you were doing the challenge largely on your own. But there were times when, you know, someone would appear in a car and they'd be there saying, you know, we're here to support you, or we've come to walk with you, or and you got a real lift out of just having that company and support, and also people saying, you know, they've been inspired by you, or they wanted to share their story with you because they saw that you were sharing your story.
Yeah, I think it's about creating that multiplier effect. You know, one conversation becomes another conversation, and so on and so on, and gives people hope, because gives people that chance to get through whatever they're going through, not just in mental ill health, but with every challenge. And I think building that trust can only be a good thing for any business. And it only takes one person to put their hand up first.
Everything just starts with one small step.
Yeah. I mean, the small steps analogy is one I use a lot, you know, is that, and I use a video from Everest and the ice fall to demonstrate the point, is that actually we waste so much energy worrying about what's going to happen in the future and the uncertainty, when really sometimes all we can control is 2 meters below our feet. So let's just focus on small steps rather than being complacent and falling off the ladder completely.
Yes. And looking ahead, you know, because obviously, as you say, you're 24, but you've achieved all these different things already, you know, so the walking challenges, Three Peaks Challenge, Mont Blanc, Himalayas, you've got your fundraising walks, your, you know, cycling challenges, you know, your Everest experiences. So what's next for Alex Staniforth?
Good question. I guess that's the challenge, is that obviously when you're on the mountain, there's always going to be another peak, as the book suggests. And that has been a challenge, is constantly having to adapt and, you know, find new challenges and deal with the quiet times. And I think I'm always busy with, you know, speaking work, especially when it gets to busy times like now. I've got plans for another challenge next spring, which will be a record attempt, another UK-based challenge. I've not done anything physically big. I've not done any outdoor challenges for, well, I did 2 marathons last year, but since Climbing UK, really. And that's been very frustrating for me. But I've had, you know, health problems to deal with, you know, which I've been, you know, open about, and realizing that I can't help other people without helping myself. That's another tip for, I think, you know, any business to bear in mind as well. And realize I've needed to build that foundation to be able to keep on doing this long term. and planning to come back with a bang though, you know, when I'm physically and mentally ready. So I'm really excited about that challenge. So if people follow me, they'll hear about that soon. And just generally trying to, you know, keep the mountain going, keep sharing the journey, speaking more and more, really enjoying that. The new challenges, and obviously the Mind Over Mountains venture is really exciting, and looking to partner with as many, you know, businesses to not only support their employees but people in the community as well. So yeah, lots of exciting stuff happening really, and just trying to share what I've learned so far.
Fantastic. And I'm curious to know, you know, what makes you do all this stuff? What drives you, Alex?
I would say, you know, I guess the books will explain better than I can now, but I think ultimately I'm still trying to answer that. I think as we all are, we're all trying to work out our place in the world and why we're here and what our purpose is. But I think it's really to achieve above adversity. You know, it's to achieve as much as I can in my lifetime and make the biggest positive contribution that I can, you know, never to be limited by challenges. And having had that experience at Everest, I think that's definitely really taught me the importance of achieving my potential, living life on my own terms. And for me, that looks like achieving as much as I can, but for a reason, you know, achieving meaningful things that can, you know, inspire others to discover that for themselves.
Great. And I'm going to ask, might be a tough question or a naughty question for you. Everest, you've obviously had a couple of attempts now. Is Everest completely off the table, or is it a case of never say never?
So I guess like anybody now, I'm trying to find my next Everest. The mountain doesn't have that same calling that it did. I mean, I love Nepal. I love to go back to Nepal. But I'm just going to say not yet, because I think there's bigger challenges close to home that can make a bigger difference. And I think from an altitude point of view, you know, I've never been very good at altitude. I think I would be better going back when I'm a bit older. And also, I don't want it enough. You know, that burning desire isn't strong enough at the moment. I have to wait for that to come back first, really.
And as you say, you've got time on your side. So it's the mountain's still going to be there, even with all the climate change going on, it's still going to be there.
Yeah, for a while.
And so to sum up, I mean, if you had one piece of advice for somebody who's thinking about either, you know, where they want to go in life and just doing stuff, I mean, what would you say to somebody who's maybe got a little seed of an idea or a thought that they want to sort of do a bit more with things, or just they would like to be able to, you know, cope better with things? What would you say?
That would be two different things. I mean, people that have an ambition and people that are struggling with a current challenge. I think for the people that have a goal but perhaps are, you know, aren't sure or aren't, you know, are scared to take that first step, I think my advice, the biggest obstacle is ourselves. You know, we're capable of so much more than we think. And I think get a mentor who believes in you as much as you do. And the best way to do that is just to speak to people, to get out there and ask. For people that are struggling at the moment, I think, well, it may sound like a bit cliched, but there is always another peak. And for me, you know, whenever I've been in a low point with my mental health, I've always known that, you know, there is some piece of you at the top. You know, you just got to keep on going and find something to keep you going in the meantime. That whole thing of relentless forward motion, you know, just keep on going and you'll get there.
Great advice. And finally, Alex, I mean, if people want to find out more about you or to get in touch or to find out more about the books, what's the best way for them to do that?
Sure, the best place would be my website, alexsonnyhorf.com. That's the best place to get links to all my social media. You can email me, read my blogs, get my books signed online, or just search my name on social media. I'm on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We'd love to hear from you and hear about some of your challenges as well.
Great. And just to repeat that, so you can find Alex on his website at alexstaniforth.com. That's alexstaniforth.com.
That's right. Spot it right. A lot of people don't know.
I've had to write it and see it quite a few times, and it's also in front of me on the book covers, in front of me for Another Peak, your second book, and Icefall, your first book. Two fantastic reads. And it just remains for me to say, Alex, thank you so much for joining us on Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast. It's been brilliant talking with you again, and I wish you every success in your future challenges.
Thank you very much, Gary. I've really enjoyed the chat. Really good to go into the story, and the questions have been fantastic. So thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. All the best, Alex.
Thanks, Gary. Can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? 'Cause we're on a mission. Listen, it's beyond description. We don't want to fit in.